Dr. Kuntz, how do you talk to your kids about Teowaki?
I don't. Not out of some, reticence about exposing them to sad or weird things. I mean, they learn the Bible, so
Right.
they should have some acquaintance with the idea that things go away or that things fall apart. But I guess I try to do it by giving them a sense of where we came from and that there was a time when essentially we had nothing and basically everything was Indian country. And I don't just mean in the sense of possession by assorted tribes. I mean dangerous, wild, difficult, hostile to us, and that we can therefore survive through practically anything because our family did before. So we have to do the things that they did. And I not in the sense of, bushcraft or farming or something, not just those kinds of things, but that we have to rely on God and stick together. So I don't need to create in them. They have plenty of time as adults to speculate about what could go wrong or how it would go wrong if it did. But I try to prepare them for hardship or difficulty in that way by telling them what we did before and that it did work, that if we rely on God and stick together, we will be okay.
I like that. I wish I had the luxury in a sense. I had exposed my kids to media influences pretty heavily through most of our lives, and it's only been the last 3 years that I've believed in my own capacity as a father to enact a, what do you call it, a storyline in the home, in which the machines are not our friends. That's kind of a key part of the new storyline. We can use them, they're tools, but they're not our friends. And so, my family's got a lot more of the whole story flowing through before I even get to say anything, even with the attempts I've made to clarify. And I've certainly also been, I don't know, with our kids' education at least, I always want to give them the full scope. So I don't, if they ask, I don't like hide it from them or something like that. And so anyhow, and one of the things that then our family I did have to address, and we still continue to walk this learning curve together, was something out of the Aguirre book, which probably the thing that stunned me most out of that entire book was when he said, it's when it all goes down, it's all going to turn left, it's all going to go sideways, people are going to be hungry, people are going to be fighting, blah, blah, blah. Your family is going to argue until you die. He just kind of said that to you as a reader. And I went, huh. We're going to sit there and debate who's in charge. We're going to quibble over things that might matter on a sunny day, right? But when it is pushed to shove and we need a leader to follow, you reader, he said, you're not one. And I took that with a not too much salt, right? I took that with some seriousness, and have been then trying to work with my family, who we don't have roots like you do at all. I can't build on that. Trying to convince them though that through the mutual understanding of the gospel, the kingdom of Jesus Christ, a shared trust in his capacity to guide, lead, reform, save us in the present, that with attention to his Holy Spirit's work, we are prepared for whatever comes our way. That said, then again, I'd like to have those stories around our dinner table be a little less about Ukraine, and not Ukraine too often, but voter fraud and inoculations are hard to keep out of their eyes. And more health crises that involve toxic food supplies, the people who they run into that are in, for us it's the jiu-jitsu community, but whatever other communities you run into whose worldviews are a radical, just radical, and having to prepare them for like, well, how do you not like make faces at that person who's making faces at you? And that kind of thing. So I know you're doing that too. And so I don't mean to say that your answer doesn't. I'm envious of your answer and the kind of capacity to lay a long story that you have.
I think it also has to do with the fact that in a crisis, a lot of things that are matters of choice fall away. And so metaphorical things fall away, metaphorical family, metaphorical steadfastness, a lot of the things that decorate rhetoric, like you said, on sunny days. So third order or second order things that are matters of great consternation and frustration and obsession in first order crises of how are we gonna stay alive, or I think maybe more along Aguirre lines, like how are we going to thrive in a situation of gradual decline of a variety of things, right? Because part of the point of that Aguirre book that we've talked about before, and the listeners can look that up if they're new to the podcast or if they're not doing the back catalog listen, for which we should hand out some kind of prize.
I know that's, merit badges or something.
That's hundreds of hours. So if you want to write into the show and say, you know, and maybe provide a screenshot of, you know, it's actually been played or something, or we'll just trust you that you've listened to the whole back catalog having started last year or something, you know. But the Aguirre book about surviving hard times is really about the gradual decline of Argentina. And that in a situation like that, I think it's important to realize that you are given in what are called the orders of creation, but particularly in the three estates, family, church, and let's say government generally, various levels, you're given first order realities. And you do see this worked out throughout history, particularly with the estate of government, because you can see how, if you know geography and you know who had military power, you can generally explain what happened. But if you don't know military history, if you just know something you were taught in undergrad about, you know, whatever, women's lives in 15th century Florence, you don't really understand what occurred and why. So when you go down to these first order things, I guess what I'm trying to get at with my kids is that there are a lot of things that are matters of choice, and they might be interesting to you, and they might be fun, and they might be stimulating, or they might be obsessively depressing, the way the news often is for people. But there's a sense in which finally it doesn't matter. It just doesn't matter. And there are situations like collapse, like emergency, but also like death, which I think is the best way to think about these things, that show you in a ready, clear way what are first order things, and therefore what's in the first rank of my priorities in life, and what am I going to center my life around. And almost everything else falls away pretty rapidly. There's a very rapid, clean, intense process of exfoliation that occurs when you examine your life in terms of death. And that enables you to make choices, I think, much more readily than if you try to sift, which is a lot of times what listeners' personal questions are about. How do I sift? Or how do you sift? And the answer is, in a simple way, the answer is I don't. Because part of the reason that I study the past more than I read the news is because by the time I read the news, when I do, and it's not like I live in a cave, but by the time I read the news, it's not nearly so unclear or interesting in its flow as when, you know, you just read the news, where it's like, well, what else do I need to know? What am I missing? If I read about a country that is, you know, pretending that military strength doesn't matter, okay, well, then I'm reading about a country that's controlled by another country. That's really pretty clear, right? That's extremely clear historically. So history is just one version, or it's a long-term collective version of thinking about your own death.
Yeah. Coming to terms with a planet in which we all die.
Yeah.
And that that factor is sort of the driving power behind almost all daily decisions,
yeah,
whether we acknowledge it or not. And we don't acknowledge it. We live in kind of hiding from it. So I asked you to do a little digging for me on a historical tidbit that yeah. is probably a bit weird, but then again, I don't know. I'll see if I can tie it all together. But I'm the question I asked you to find out for me was on the history of the mirror,
yeah,
as a American middle class commoner phenomena. And particularly with reference to the old language of it being a vanity. So my question, Dr. Koontz, is really like when did America decide that being vain was, you know, the most necessary thing in our cultural existence? I don't mean that we made a decision. I mean, we see that the mirror simply became what we assume we do.
Yeah.
I think that's a big change in our history, and I'd love to know what you found.
So there are two different streams to figuring that out. And one is the fact that until you are able to manufacture glass that is sufficiently clear and reproducible, right? So that you have production capacity to get high quality glass out there, the production of mirrors as we think of them is going to be pretty low until the 19th century. And one way to see this actually is to just look in the Bible to see where there are mirrors. And there are, in fact, very few, right? Your two clearest ways to think about this in biblical terms are when Paul talks about seeing, he says, see in a glass. And that's just an old way to talk about a mirror, because most people's acquaintance with glass besides drinking vessels is going to be small mirrors. We see in a glass darkly. That's because the glass is fairly impure. It's highly impure compared to modern glass. We see in a glass darkly, so we don't really see a whole lot. We see some vague resemblance to ourselves. And James is going to talk about the man who sees his face and then goes away and forgets what he has seen. And that is because he has rare access to such things, right? So part of the reason he can forget, I mean, James is trying to tell you, when you see yourself in light of God's word, when you're doing it infrequently, you're not really grasping who you are. You don't actually know what you've seen. And this, in the same way that a lot of people have more insight about the imperfections of other people's noses than they do about their own, the reason they can have insight about their own is when they have access to the sight of that. But to see that frequently, unless you are pretty wealthy, is very rare before the Industrial Revolution. So this is a case of technology making something possible that was never possible before. So that's the other stream, is the idea of mass-produced vanities. So if before, the common way in human history to see yourself is to find a still pool of water, that's the story of Narcissus. Right, he's looking into a pond when he sees himself and becomes obsessed and says that, you know, he says, I love you, right, to himself. And then poor Echo, who's hiding over there in the willows, all she can say is, I love you. And he doesn't care. That story is based on how most people are going to see themselves, which is in water. If by the time of the 19th century, you can see yourself in a vanity, the insight there is still that what's happening is really that you're satiating something that in a way is pointless. And this has to do with human beauty. So a lot of people will talk about beauty today in a lot of fields, partly because we don't have a lot of it. People present themselves kind of in an ugly, dressed down, casual, but that is to say, I don't care what I look like to you way. And that goes for both men and women. In addition to the buildings we live in, the environment around us, which is occupied by strip malls and cracked concrete. So people are obsessed with beauty, I think partly because we have relatively little of it. That doesn't mean that we're finding it necessarily or that we are displaying it. But the idea of the vanity is, it's kind of a great title for the area where the woman gets herself ready, because there is a need both inside of her and in those looking at her to be beautiful. So there's something necessary about a vanity. There's also a recognition that there's something futile about it. And futile, F-U-T-I-L-E, is important along with its synonym, vain, V-A-I-N, because that word vain means at the same time, it's kind of silly or it makes you prideful, but it also means that it's kind of pointless in the end. Because the woman who is looking into the vanity, the very thing that she's looking for is itself, and the word that we use is very telling here, it's fading, like the colors in a painting that's been exposed to sunlight too long. So there's something going on here that I think captures, and this is, the vanity is really particular to women's lives, but it captures something that's true about human beings generally, which is we can use something, we can make something relatively new, certainly new in its clarity in the mirrors that we're able to produce. But that's not going to arrest the processes that themselves prove in the end to be vain. Because eventually there's going to be, you know, there's going to be death, and then nobody looks pretty, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It's very like us to take a new power and to use it in the most self-destructive way.
Yeah.
That's just unto our nature.
Right.
So yeah, I mean, that's really helpful. I have been mulling on this for quite a while, and so let me see if I can get a little crazier.
Sure.
Take it through a few steps backwards.
Yeah.
What got me most was the day that I realized I was watching a talking image and listening to it.
Yeah.
Without ever realizing, like, oh, talking image, Bible, bad. Like, and I'm not at the point where I want to tell everyone that every picture that talks is therefore the Antichrist and you're going to hell. Like, that's going a little too far, I think. But to realize that, you know, for anybody who is outside of the faith of Jesus Christ, for them to watch a talking image is for them to worship it. And that this is going on all around us. So I started pondering, you know, the infiltration of the talking image as a normative factor of Western civilization that nobody questions. We just do what it says.
Yeah.
In 1984, George Orwell and all that. Sure, fine. I'm still thinking Book of Revelation just a touch, even though I don't really believe there's a little season that's separate from the millennium, which is the eternal reign of Christ that's already initiated. You know, a little season is going to be right now to the end of the world,
right,
and then the rest of the kingdom. So I'm not really looking for like the you know, the hat tip on, oh, we're at the end times now. But I can't ignore the talking image that everybody's worshiping. And as I was pondering that,
yeah,
and its overlap with things like twisted light, like that's how it works, it all came to congeal again and seeing in the mirror my face that was talking to me about these very things. And I realized I had another talking image that I was listening to.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, golly, if I ain't just going to be kersnuckled by this thing, I would like to not be an idolater by intention. John's final words of his letter, you know, little children, keep yourselves from these things. I am not an iconoclast. I don't intend to become one. But there's something about the twisted light, the refractive or the reflective nature that isn't true, and the futility of our pursuits that we want to use. If I can summarize my learning, why do we take pictures? And it's because we want to hold on to what God's taken away. And that factor, from Shinto to Alan Jones, you know, Alex Jones, you know, it doesn't seem to matter to me if we're not waking up from the domineering spirit that causes us to listen to so many things that are not the scriptures. then we're going to continue being railroaded into, if nothing else, our own vanity. Right. I mean, if nothing else, it's just a practical question, but I think it's more than just a practical question too.
Okay. So I think this has to do with a question of images generally, and then maybe we can move through time to talk about moving images, to talk about the shrinking of the moving image from a giant screen that you sit in generally a nicely appointed room to watch with other people, originally with live music and even with a live narrator. Just a cool little fact about film history is that Japan held on to the live music and the live narrator longer than anyone else. That even after talkies came out at the very end of the 20s, beginning of the 30s, Japan held on to a live narrator longer than anywhere else.
They have always had a sense for the arts, I think.
Well, they certainly have like a highly cultivated aesthetic sense, and holding on to the live narrator keeps some semblance of life about what it is that you're looking at. You move from that into TV, so now it's completely privatized, and from there you move to completely individualized streaming on your phone, so that you can now be in the same room and be watching, you know, three different things, the three people in that room. If you go all the way back to the question of images, I am always struck by the relative bareness of Northern European architecture. And it's an impulse that you see in these populations when they have different religious convictions. So Lutheran churches and Methodist churches, and not Mormon temples, but Mormon stakes, right? Local churches are all Baptist churches. Even when they don't have a religious conviction against images, strictly speaking, they tend to be fairly bare and fairly abstract. And I'm speaking even before modern architecture, that they are relatively unadorned by images. When they do have images, it'll be a matter of focus up front. If you contrast that with, say, Slavic church architecture, Roman Catholic, you know, Byzantine Rite, Eastern Orthodox, even also Slavic Lutherans, it's going to be much more adorned. Even the decoration in the architecture of Slavic Reformed people, like there's a large Reformed church, always has been a large Reformed church in Hungary, is more ornate in its decoration. Where there's a religious conviction against images per se, there's still more decoration than among the Scottish. So what's interesting to me is that images have a power that some people are more willing to concede to than others. Here's the thing. I think everyone's heart is full of images, right? That's why the warning against idolatry strikes at the heart. I think everyone, regardless of his culture, his background, whatever, his heart is full of images. What different cultures choose to do about that. So let's be fairly iconoclastic. I mean, you mentioned Shinto, and Shinto is in some ways one of the most, to my mind, iconoclastic of pagan religions. Usually inside the temple, there isn't an image. You know, there's a profusion of images in a Buddhist temple. There is almost a complete abstraction in a Shinto temple. What you do with that, and with the heart full of images and ready to manufacture more, I think that's really the question. For a Christian, part of the potential of images is because Christ is alive. And so therefore, those who are in him are also alive. So an image of Abraham or Isaac or Jacob in a church or in my home is a reminder of life. It's not a pointless seeking after death, which in a milder form is nostalgia. So if you think about the difference between having an icon of Abraham, for example, or for personal reasons, I like icons of Adam. They're not very common.
Find a Jonathan one for me.
Yeah, those are probably even rarer. But that is something different than if I have a picture of life in the town where my grandparents met in the decade that they met, right? Olean, New York in the 1930s is never coming back. It's gone.
Yeah.
Right? It's still there, but that's gone. So there's a difference here between images that are reminders of life and images that are reminders of death. One of the things about a vanity or what those images do to my heart is whether they create greater affirmation of life, greater trust in God, or whether they create death. And that does actually depend on my heart, because some images have no effect on me, but they might have a strong effect on you and vice versa. I think that one of the things about the power of the moving image, whatever size the screen is that because it gives such a good facsimile of reality to any human being, the power that it has is that it doesn't really have to ask to pull the heart. It just can. In the same way that eye contact has much greater power in speaking than not making eye contact. So when you're thinking about images and what pulls the heart, because the heart is just going to be there and it's going to have and want images and it will be pulled. Those are just properties of mankind. Then you want to ask yourself, okay, well, what kind of images am I being pulled by? Because their power will be greater than words, than smells, than other things that affect your senses. Those image, because one way to see this is if you have like a sort of, you know, Marcel Proust type event where you are moved by a certain smell or taste, so you take other senses. When that occurs, for Proust, it was this madeleine dipped in the, you know, we would call it herbal tea. When that happens, notice that what your heart does is that it brings up certain images, that certain smells that remind you of childhood, they bring up images, whereas the image doesn't need a smell or a sound or a taste to supplement it, but that those other things will supplement themselves with images, if at all possible.
Yeah, the tendency to rely on sight as our dominant truth finder,
yeah,
is pretty there. And, you know, notwithstanding stories of those who've lost sight and discovered the power of the other senses. So there was so much good there again. And especially in diagnosing, lest anyone think otherwise, you know, the iconoclastic confusion error to see how the incarnation, death, and resurrection of our Lord Jesus Christ has made his image, the crucified man, the mark of his kingdom,
yeah,
the sign of his triumph. And from there flows all beauty restored. But in the same vein then, same kind of ponderings over the last couple of years, you know, for a Christian in faith, getting ready for your day in front of the mirror, you know, you're fine, probably, you know, guard your heart. For the non-Christian, it's an idol, has to be. There's no other option. Dogmatically, it just can't be. They have to worship it. They must. And so with that kind of awareness in mind, that pagans, unbelievers, they don't have faith to attach to Christ, and so all their good works are filthy rags. So also, the realm of art is effectively the realm of magic. It's the realm of image crafting for the sake of casting forward a spirit, really, a feeling, a belief, whatever they want to call it.
Yeah, okay.
And so just again to see that what the issue isn't that Christians can't. The issue is Christians need to realize we do it different and then start doing it different and stop doing it just like everybody else.
Yeah.
Because following their trains are getting us to their destinations.
I think that particularly with Christians, and this is not my absolute despisal of modern architecture. I think blanket despising of any given time, I'm not saying any given trend or any given artist or architect is silly, because it does not recognize God's providence. However, the trend towards abstraction is always a trend for a Christian in a direction of immense profusion that is privatized. So rather than have something definite to look at or definite to understand, so there's a sense in which a steeple of almost any kind is fairly abstract, but we understand that a steeple could be highly abstract or, you know, fairly straightforward in what it's presenting. And we don't expect there to be tons of ornament on a steeple. But you'll notice that generally human beings have more ornament, decoration, definition, the closer to human life and human eyes and our line of sight that it gets. So down where we are, right, we don't expect mementos of our family life to be on the roofs of our homes. But it would be a little weird, and it's always telling when you go into somebody's house and they have no family pictures of anyone from ever, right? If that's the case, then you're kind of like, okay, why? You know, what causes you to avoid that? They might have their reasons. Usually those reasons are pretty deep and usually have to do with pain. So when you're thinking about what kinds of images are going to be there, when there's abstraction or there's nothing, particularly in a human line of sight that actually is an image of anything or anyone, what you want to think about is, okay, well, what's going to happen to the hearts that live here? And I think what occurs at that point is that you get immense variety, not necessarily good, but definitely variety, because there's nothing in front of everyone's eyes. If you've ever been in a Unitarian church, this is fairly easy to understand because they're going to be generally extremely abstract. Not necessarily an architectural style, because they might have inherited the building from the 18th or 19th century, but inside the decoration will be very abstract. And when it's not, it will be something probably old and protected by some kind of, you know, Antiquities Act of some kind that they just can't get rid of that bust of John Adams or something. But otherwise, there will be abstraction. And so notice that generally with high abstraction goes immense diversity of hearts. And I mean that in terms of beliefs, but also in terms of attitudes and perceived purposes and things like that. When you have a uniting image, so here are images of our family, or here are images of our God, or here, then you are also providing a focus in the way that Hollywood does for the heart to fix itself on.
Yeah. And to see the inherent nature of man in this, that there, you can't really avoid yet. There must be an image that you look to, and that is what father and mother are created to be. If I get Luther right in the Large Catechism, that we are the images of God to the children, it is in the world that things are falling apart that we erect these counter images, nostalgic narratives, built on some shared pain, I think you just said, and that's very insightful, to hold us together. And it's, again, I'm not saying this as like some blanket condemnation. I'm not saying you can try to avoid this. I'm saying Christians should not be ignorant of this broken part of our nature and of how readily it gets out of control without some convictions about what we're doing with these images, and how it is very easy for a human in America to collect boxes and boxes and boxes and boxes of images while failing to mend relationships with the people in those very pictures. They're living right there, right?
So, right. Yeah, right. And I mean, the decline of photo albums, like albums of all kinds, because albums are something that you use, to collect generally either images or signatures or mementos of other people. That's what they were for. and albums predate mirrors in any kind of widespread use. There were albums. This is sometimes, especially where you get old drawings that you might be familiar with if you are interested in whatever, Jane Austen's England or something. You're getting those drawings or watercolors from someone's album, and they would take them around and have people sign them, but also draw mementos of what they've seen. The capacity also to draw as a matter of common educational training, that you can sketch a bird that you saw or sketch a home that you stayed in when you were, you know, traveling. All of that has to do with the capacity not only to receive images, but also to produce images. And this was even to the extent, my doctoral advisor wrote a whole book about this particular thing. That's why I am personally interested in it. But what she wrote about is something that in rhetoric has its own fancy word we can use if we want to, but it's basically the capacity in the preacher. So she was writing about the church fathers. That's what she does. The capacity in the preacher to put an image in front of people's minds.
Yeah.
It's called ekphrasis in Greek. And what that means is that you are accepting the fact that they need to receive the word of God through hearing. How will they hear without someone preaching? That's the way that God has chosen to reveal himself to mankind primarily, not solely. There's also the sacraments, right? But primarily through preaching, and even the sacraments are accompanied by God's word. But that what you are doing is you are accepting the fact that human beings live through images. So you are trying to create in front of their mind's eye an image. And that's, I mean, it's telling that we have the phrase mind's eye, but not ear's eye or nose's eye or, you know, the other senses. So even when we're trying to express that something really is right there in front of us and we're really grasping it, and you know, and Paul says this to the Galatians, I placarded Christ in front of you as crucified.
Right.
So you're just accepting that they're going to think, even in their thinking, as if they were seeing. And you want to make sure that right in front of their eyes is a very clear image of the sacrifice of Isaac or of Paul's labors for the church's night and day or whatever it is that you're trying to do, because that will be the image in their heart, right? And the heart doesn't actually itself physically see, it understands, biblically speaking, but it believes in what it sees, as it were. And so the heart's perception is then governed by the images that have been given to it. And if those images are predominantly of God, of his life, of these kinds of things, then the heart will simply be attached very, very differently than if primarily, and this is where, you know, education comes up as so desperately important, than if primarily the images are privatized, are governed by algorithms, are governed by profit, are governed by dissent or appeal to the worst that is in you, then of course your heart is going to be warped. I mean, what else could possibly happen?
Yeah. So where I'd like to go a little bit with this now is, you know, speaking of images and caricatures, there was a series I read years ago. I shouldn't say I read it. I watched it. It had been turned into an anime from the graphic novel that it originally was. But, you know, it's amazing where you find good story, and to dismiss either film or theater or various groups of fiction, genres of fiction, as if no, you know, insightful author could be there, I found that to be a mistake. And in this case, the storyline of The Full Metal Alchemist, for those who want to check it out, it's got some real genius to it, and largely in this, that the spin of the bad guys who build their way all to the great epic end is a play up on the seven deadly sins by name. And it does such a great job of picturing these people, greed, wrath, you know, lust, pride. It's such a good way of describing them, making them be who they are, that I almost can't think of the seven deadly sins now without those images being who I then, you know, reckon I've got to deal with. What's been more valuable recently is believing that dealing with the seven deadly sins is worth my time. That is, that as a framework for combating my own cantankerousness per se, or, you know, tendency to fall apart myself, that it is the seven deadly sins that give me a nice place for the fruit of the spirit to go to war with, you know, things that I can see my greed and I can hate my greed. And that's a good thing.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And so from there, this to me is not disconnected from the whole concept of the vanity, the tendency of us to follow images that promise us we'll be who we think we ought to be, and the real slippery slope that most of us are amassing around us simply by having a greed for images themselves, a desire just to have them, keep them for their own sake, without, you know, again, the bigger kingdom per se,
yeah,
in view.
Okay. I mean, I think the reason the seven deadly sins are helpful is simply because it is a list. And catechisms, like preaching, have to recognize that human beings need organization. For example, they can't just listen to, you know, blather for 40 minutes or blather endlessly. You need to be organized and clear. And the seven deadly sins organize in a clear way something that appears all over the Bible and is so frequent that it has its own name by people who study the Bible, called vice lists. So rather than, you know, memorizing every vice list and trying to cross-check it, as you have to do when you use different writers in the Bible, because they'll use more or fewer words depending on their preference. James is extremely compressed. And some people go on and on and on. I love James. But what the seven deadly sins do is that they sum things up. This goes pretty far back. I believe the first list in church history, there are vice lists outside of and before the church, but the first list in church history is Tertullian. So that's a very early North African church father. You also get in the 4th century, Evagrius Ponticus, who's, I don't know if you can tell from his name, is Greek, proto-Byzantine, you might say. And he's got 9, and he pulls them into 8 things. Among those are 7 deadly sins, but some are kind of, you'll notice that when people's lists are different, it's because they're usually expanding something that they think is more important. So in the biblical vice lists, you'll notice that things that are either completely internal or sexual usually have more words for them, indicating you kind of need a finer-toothed comb on things that are internal or sexual problems than you do for raising up hands in anger. Like Paul says, don't do that. Raise your hands up in prayer instead in 1 Timothy. But, you know, raising your hands in anger, there's kind of only one outcome to that. Whereas things that are internal and or sexual sins or vices are going to be both more frequent and need more words to describe them so that you know what you're dealing with, in the same way that, you know, people who spend a lot of time outside know way more words for soil conditions and weather and, you know, Eskimo words for snow, because you deal with this all the time and you need to know what you're handling. When you think about these things as not just sins, but vices, I like that word, that these are vicious, because what they do is not just that you commit them and that's wrong. And, you know, I've railed against this before and I'll do it again. We need to stop using speed limit signs as an illustration for God's law. It's just not a good idea because we all know it's quasi or entirely arbitrary. So there are people who remember when you had to go 55 on interstates and it was stupid, right? It was dumb. It's at least quasi, if not entirely arbitrary, but it also doesn't express, like, you know, because guess what? If I go 55 and a 30 and nobody catches me, it doesn't do anything to me. Whereas what happens with sins, and especially when we think of sins as vices, is that it destroys me by and by, so that these things, they are vicious to me. My pride or my vanity or my gluttony is vicious to me. It could be vicious to other people. It's definitely vicious to me, the offender. So when you think about the seven deadly sins or the seven vices contrasted with seven virtues, which we can talk about if you want, but the seven vices, that's just a summary of things that destroy me, or a summary of ways in which I destroy myself.
Yeah, right. They are descriptions of the way my spirit goes wrong.
Right.
And what I like about that is, as opposed to, and I'm going to teach the small catechism, but like the Ten Commandments as my only vector for how to lead a righteous life leaves me either with the external alone,
yeah,
which is too easy, most agree, or with, at this point, sort of the Lutheran, you just never can. You're just never gonna. And, you know, try hard, but your heart's against you.
Yeah.
Well, okay, good. But I still want to fight here, right?
Right.
And
yeah.
And so the framework of the seven deadlies, I just find less of the shame and guilt baggage that, for whatever reason, my experience of Lutheran training has left me with. Ten Commandments is they don't give me teeth to fight with.
Okay.
That makes sense.
Yeah. So that's the reason that in instruction I like to combine the Ten Commandments with the Table of Duties.
Amen. Yeah.
In addition to, you can just run off the Table of Duties and supply viceless and virtueless from the Bible. And the reason I like to do that is because, for example, let's just take the chief commandment in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, which is the eighth commandment, not the first, but the eighth, right?
Well, it's only the explanation that's really right. The chief. Yeah.
And the way that that actually works is that the eighth commandment is used. So obviously I'm not impugning God's commandments. I'm impugning our stupidity in applying them. The eighth commandment is used to keep people from saying things that are not nice. And the problem there is that niceness is only a third or a second order virtue. It's not a primary virtue. It's not prudence. It's not temperance. It's not chastity. It's not faith. It's not hope. Niceness is definitely not love, because you can be nice and hate the person at the same time. So what we're looking at when we look at the eighth commandment is, for example, instead of thinking about commandments in terms of, did I behave relative to other people? Because the way that we interpret the eighth commandment as like, don't say anything about anyone ever. Okay. And I feel very free and happy to say what I'm saying right now, because people impugn me, Pastor Fisk, Pastor Grills, all the time. Here's why it doesn't bother me, in short, is because when you think about vices and virtues, you have to realize that other people's sins are not actually your primary problem in life. Certainly not stupid things other people say about you. They are primarily his problem. And when you start to think about sins as a way of diagnosing one's own problems, you know, tellingly, this chief or theological or accusatory use of the law is called in Lutheran shorthand the mirror, right? Is that you need to realize that the biggest problem here is you, not the other guy, you know, including his, you know, dumb thoughts, opinions, characterizations, right? That doesn't mean that defamation is okay. It means that when you think about defamation, or the way that we usually talk about it as slander, because we're usually doing it in a private forum as gossip rather than a public forum, which is what defamation or libel might be considered, that, you know, it's not like that's okay, but you need to understand that the primary problem here isn't that he did it in public. It's that what has come forth from his heart is such uncleanness, proceeding from maybe pride, maybe wrath, maybe his own sloth, which is therefore offended by another's action, whatever it might be. But the reason I find the virtues and vices very helpful for thinking about these things is because they diagnose not just what has been done externally, but also what is occurring internally. That's much more helpful for understanding oneself as well as other people than simply to think about what has happened externally. Because what thinking only about externals does is it makes the breach of external, possibly very superficial peace the greatest offense. And that's why the Eighth Commandment has taken on the proportions in our midst that it has, or that in other forms with traditions, with other numberings of the commandments, being winsome takes on the same importance, or being gospel-centered, which means winsome, which means nice, has taken on importance. I mean, there are different words for this phenomenon in different groups, but the reason that does, or the reason that externals and external peace and external niceness take on such importance, is because we don't really have much of a sense of what is happening internally when sin is committed, that it's vicious, that it's destructive, that it proceeds from the heart, and so forth.
Where there is no unity, the appearance of unity is all the more necessary.
Yes. Yes, that right. Is correct. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So for my part, I'll go on record and say that greed and the other image in my life that tends to give me trouble,
yeah.
I realized the image of exchange. I don't care for Washington. I like Benjamin a lot more. He's my favorite image of exchange. that factor out of the book of Revelation also remains at play. You know, while the radicals want to always pin the tail on the mark of the beast, somewhere underneath this all, it's been the coinage of images and our hoarding of them for ourselves to the detribution of the poor. There's been the problem all along. And it's why the civilizations rise and fall. It's why Jerusalem is rejected again and again. When Jesus is in the temple, says, "Throw me the coin," you know, here's whose image is this? It's all kind of been there. And so as I, you know, wake up again in February of 2024 and chart a course toward, I don't know what economic scenario, quote unquote, the world has ahead of me, along with my own need for vanity and submission to the whatever stories the talking image in my mirror had given me for so many years, and dropping that at the cross of Christ, and right beside it, and that's why I'm saying it publicly here, the manner in which I let the story of the U.S. dollar tell me how to feel day in and day out. I mean, dear Jesus, let me repent and teach me a better way. It's just so sad, these little tiny pictures on pieces of paper. And the more that I put it in that category, you know, as I think about the bills that'll be due, and I guess, like, oh, hold on, okay, how many little idols do I have to wrap up here and send somewhere digitally to make sure they all get happy, they got their household gods for the week, right? That to me has been a tremendous freedom. It doesn't mean that all the problems are gone, but this framework of the seven deadlies is where I'm getting it. And recognition that the human capacity for image worship is unparalleled. We are redeemed. So let us walk at liberty as those who are wise and do what our flesh is about, right? And again, let the word of the kingdom be the thing that drives us to and for and with each other.
The connection between images and vanity in any given vice is an interesting one, because it links what we've been talking about with the sense of vanity, I think, as futility, that we haven't talked as much about, but is certainly there whenever either Solomon is considering life under the sun, not above the sun, but under the sun, or when Paul is talking about why are you enslaving yourselves again? If you could be saved through the law, then Christ has died in vain. And that sense of futility to one's life is the one that I think is probably haunting most people. So they might have, they have very, you know, various images filling their hearts. They're pursuing this, they're pursuing that. They're those are probably going to be second order or third order things. I mean, it's not that I think it's impossible that family is an idol for many people. I don't particularly think it's helpful when people don't really know how to organize their family time or discipline their children to just denounce family as an idol in the sermon and move on as if you've done your job, because probably their family life, which is worthwhile sacrificing for, is highly disordered, poorly managed, because second and third order things are overtaking everything, particularly the family's time and life together. So this is something, especially for preachers, like please understand what is actually occurring in people's lives so that you have some insight into what is actually wrong, rather than just denouncing things that, you know, maybe in 1950 people were taking care of as a matter of course, but they're not today. But what's going to happen is that even, let's say your family is an idol, the problem here, and Solomon knows, he's got plenty of family and plenty of accomplishments in Ecclesiastes, is that it turns out that the things that you're striving for are, they prove to be vain. And when Paul talks about striving, therefore, he talks about having put other things aside. And when you put other things aside, this is where, you know, you're not going to be a human being who has no passions, who has no desires. What you need is for those things to be reordered. That's the purpose of the virtues as opposed to the vices, is that a virtue is not a human being who now behaves like some kind of theological robot. I have met theological robots in the flesh. They do exist in the Lutheran church, but that's not what I mean. But that you turn into somebody whose passions or whose desires or whose sight or intellect or whatever, whose powers are turned to good ends. That's what the virtues are. Right? It's the turning of man to good ends. I guess we've been denouncing that. We've been saying that Christianity is a flight from virtue. I think that made some sense at some time. I don't think it makes a lot of sense now. Christianity is instead the renovation of man, which involves a change from vice to virtue. That's a message of long standing. And that's what happens in the resurrection. It's not like in the resurrection, we are absent all virtue, but that we are completed in virtue in a way that we obviously are not before then. But the idea that there just is no virtue or virtue is not worth pursuing is really the idea that, you know, finally love, which is the summary of the commandments, is itself vain, and that is not something the Bible says. So even Solomon can say that, you know, so much of life is vain. The stuff you thought mattered, your career ladder, your sense of this is my job title, whatever it is, that was vain, yes. But to fear God, that is also to love and trust in him, is not vain. So love is not some kind of vanity. The talents you've been given to work with are not vain, right? The one who lives in vain is the guy who buries his talent. So I think the idea that virtue is somehow the enemy and vice is not, that was a mistake. That was a mistake when we started talking that way.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
What it meant is that we begin to talk as if the things occurring in people's lives are not actually occurring in a way that for centuries and centuries and centuries, not only by, you know, those evil Roman Catholics or something, but for centuries and centuries, we were trying to figure out what is the matter with people. And we said, they have these vices. Here are some lists, right? It's not everything, but it's a lot. It's a lot of what's going wrong with them.
Well, and we're kind of almost out of time here, but it's not a bad place to have one piece of news from the week, which is a little video that sufficed arose with Nayib Bukele in it. He is the president, or was president, of El Salvador. He was under, they're voting to have him be reelected. I'm not sure how that news did turn out, but he is answering a question to a BBC reporter about the Supermax 70,000K security prison where 70,000 murderers from El Salvador have been rounded up and put there by the government to bring peace to the nation, it would seem. And it is, it's a beautiful illustration to me, Adam, of what you're just talking about, where the reporter is so caught up on a narrative attempting to expose the flaw in like punishing the wrong person accidentally.
Yeah.
That he misses that this man he's asking the question of is trying to take care of a nation of like families with kids and grandmas and all this other stuff who are just tired of 70,000 gang members running the country.
Yeah.
And he goes off. The president goes off. It's beautiful. He's like, you know, we don't get mad at you. You have a king. We let you have a king, but you want to come in. Your ideas have failed us though. That's the main thing.
Right.
We've tried your ideas. It's the very same thing. Like we're going to solve this problem of violent gangs with niceness and kind of a subtle soft touch just in case a mom gets upset somewhere.
Yeah.
So your thoughts on
that's
that.
Right. And then yeah. Well, I mean, it is always, this is a truism in theology as a narrow subset of, you know, things humans think about, but it's true in all realms of life because you're dealing with divine realities, which is the person who is against the law, set opposite to the law, the antinomian, is always also a legalist.
Yeah.
That is someone obsessed with the law. So both those people who are really the same person, they're always looking for perfection where it can't be found. Now, it's different how they express that. And it could be the same person expressing completely opposite opinions, totally contradictory stuff at one time or another. So with Bukele, if he brings order to a country completely governed by criminals for decades, then they will be legalists and demand absolute perfection in the way that he's doing that in a realm that is not possible. And so if you bring relative order to your life, you know, the legalist will demand more, which is impossible before the resurrection. Okay. So they will demand the impossible in a legalistic way. They will then, with the criminal or with the person whose vices are destroying himself, be far too soft. It doesn't matter. You can still be a Christian and do that or think that. It's fine. Okay. Because you're baptized or whatever your excuse is. You can be a gang member. It's fine. It's totally fine to have this secret society of violent men. That's cool. You know, I'm going to make sure that you don't serve too long in jail, right? The antinomian and the legalist are the same person. Okay. And that's why they will say completely opposite things in various realms, because fundamentally they're looking for perfection through the law. And when they don't find that, they will react either by acting like you're supposed to have it, legalism, or they will act like, because you can't have it, all search for order, all search for law in the government or in one's family life or something is futile and stupid. And that person is really the greatest danger in any of these realms, government, church, family, whatever, because that person is trying to seek a life that has no order. And that's not the life God gives. He doesn't give life without giving order. Right? The body, the bones of the body have an order, let alone the soul. The virtues and the vices provide you some order, some scaffolding, some bones to articulate, right? In the way that the bones structure, the skeleton structures the human body. And that's a good thing. And that clarifies your thinking, and that also sorts through the images of the heart to give you greater understanding and wisdom.
A little leaven leavens the whole lump. That's a two-way street. Can you picture it? Listen to A Brief History of Power. You know where to find us, or you wouldn't be here.
What do you think of when you hear the word college? Expensive? Liberal? Woke? Imagine a college that is affordable. A college that is unapologetically conservative and Lutheran. A college that won't take a dime of federal funding. A college that teaches the best of our Western heritage. a college where students grow in the Christian faith instead of leaving it behind. This is Luther Classical College, a college by Lutherans and for Lutherans. Visit our website, lutherclassical.org, subscribe, become a patron, and join the thousands who are making Luther Classical College a reality.
North Idaho is home to beautiful mountains and scenic lakes, small-town tranquility, civil freedom, and the faithful Lutheran parish of Blessed Sacrament Lutheran Church, located in Hayden, Idaho, near Coeur d'Alene. Blessed Sacrament Lutheran Church is a proud sponsor of A Brief History of Power. If you like what you hear on Brief History, then you will love Blessed Sacrament, where the Lord's Word is faithfully preached and Christ's body and blood are administered at every divine service. Whether you are visiting Idaho or considering moving to Idaho, wouldn't it be nice? Please join the saints of Blessed Sacrament Lutheran Church for the Mass and Augsburg Academy Bible Study. Directions, service times, and much more information about this confessional liturgical parish may be found at blessedsacramentlutheranchurch.com. Blessed Sacrament Lutheran Church, Historic Christian Orthodoxy, the Evangelical Lutheran Faith, in the beautiful Inland Northwest.